T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
Hey, good morning. Doug Sinceri, Albert Nico, your weekend lawyer. Is all things legal, give us a call at 260-1870. Good morning, Albert.
Hey, Doug, good morning. What's going on?
Nothing much. I heard the news story about the non-Oklahoma players who got tested positive for coronavirus. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to use that as a lead-in as to what I want to talk about. Just opening up the segment. We talk normally sports, so this is a little bit of sports culture. Law to a certain extent is college football this fall. Big Ten and Pac-10 said we're not going to play. The MAC has said it's not going to play. Other conferences, the SWAC decided not to play. And, you know, you hear all these panicked news stories about player safety in college football. And I sort of wanted to make the case as to, often as lawyers, you know, when we make, you know, there's closing arguments, a lot of times if you have a bad fax, you use emotion or you use other factors to try to persuade a jury. But ultimately, you know, the jury is instructed to look at the facts. Isn't that correct?
Or you use,
you know, of course. But, so I wanted to run some facts about, and we have a, you know, we're at an age where we have kids going off to college, and, you know, I guess politicians and news media has people hysterical about sending their kids to college. But let me give you some statistics, which is empirical data, is about the safety of your children going to college. Okay, I want to say, this is for the United States, and this is coronavirus. And I'm going to ask you to guess. Between the ages of 15 and 24, how many reported deaths are there for corona for individuals between 15 and 24? I mean, just what would you think?
5.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in the whole nation, is 242 people died of corona. And you know how many people died of pneumonia in that same age group? It's 441. Or 492, I'm sorry. So you've had twice as many people from the ages of 15 to 24, which are college-age students, who've died from pneumonia and flu than they did COVID.
That's school and college, from 15
to
24.
Yeah, right. 15, high school and college age. High school and college age. But they break down the statistics from 15 to 24. Now, here's an incredible statistic. And these are for all your parents who are sending your kids to college and have been made hysterical by news reports, okay? Do you know how many individuals in the state of Louisiana from the ages of 14 to 24 have died from COVID?
No, 5.
Zero. Zero.
Right.
Zero.
And zero.
And they've had, in that same age group, 296 individuals died of other causes of action. I mean, other causes of death. So let me repeat it. From the ages of 15 to 24, there have been zeros reported deaths from COVID in the state of Louisiana, where it has been 296 causes, you know, death for other causes. Now, in that same, there, as far as college football is concerned, given the empirical data, number one, why would you want to diminish a young, you know, a person's education by doing online school? Why would you want to not have something that's part of the cultural fabric of, you know, of our state, of our region, you know, college football, over player safety, where the fact is, since February 1st, zero people in the state of Louisiana from the age of 15 to 24 have died from COVID. I mean, do you have? I'm at a loss, and you
Listen,
know,
we are set up. We are set up since the last 5 or 6 months to socially distance our schools. People have Zoom. People have, you know, streaming classrooms. People have been doing online training for 10 years online. They're online, specifically online colleges, universities, all over the place. So it can be done. So if you are a student, and I'd be curious to find out of the 200 or so 15 to 24-year-old students that passed away from COVID, how many of them had one of these comorbidities that would, you know, enhance their chances. And if you had any leadership as a politician if you had any leadership, then the answer is let those kids stay home. We'll make it easy for them. We'll pay for whatever we need to pay for to let them stay home and socially distance their learning from home, because they have an issue that needs to be addressed, and they need to take care of themselves, and we need to help take care of them. But for the rest of it, go to school, go to college, go do what you want to do.
Enjoy your college experience.
Yeah, but you might pick it up and bring it home and kill your grandmother. Well, that, you know, you have a grandmother at home, and your grandmother may have some issues, or your grandfather or your father may have some heart condition or whatever. So if that's the case, instead of being locked in your house all day, go to class and wear your gloves, wear your mask, and protect yourself and keep your distance from that person that has the issue. And so then we limit whoever is quarantined or stuck at home. And God, it's sad for them, but it's sad for everybody else. I mean, deaths are up. So suicides are going through the roof. People are losing their jobs. And every person from, you know, Dr. Avegno to the mayors to, you know, the governors and everyone else that is making these orders to stay home and lock down and wear masks and all these things, they're all working. They don't have anything to lose. They're working. They're getting paid. And most of them have never run a business. They've never been in charge of a business to, you know, live or die by, you know, whatever comes in the door. And if you're living it at 25%, then people are going to close and lose their livelihoods that they've worked for all their lives because of this small percentage of the population that is at risk. And not that we shouldn't be worried about that small percentage, but that's the small percentage that should be at home and taken care of and protected. And everybody else, go get it. if you you're sick for 4 or 5 days, you're sick for 4 or 5 days. If you're sick for 10 days, people have been sick with the flu before, and it's miserable and it wears you out and you can't get out of bed and you feel terrible. And then you get over it and you move on with your life.
And that's what, just a quick statistics again, and this sort of dovetails on what you're saying, between the ages of 25 and 34 through August 12th of this year, 2,920 people died of COVID, 4,003 in the United States, and 4,367 people died of pneumonia and flu. From 45 to 54, 7,721 people have died from COVID. In that same age group, 11,432 people died of flu and pneumonia. And in the age group of 55 to 64, 18,579 people died of COVID. 29,978 people died of pneumonia and flu. So,
right.
And I'm not minimizing the death. I'm just saying what we're talking about is perspective on the cure for this particular,
portion. Needs to be a balance with the economy and everyone's livelihood. And it's just, there is no balance. And there's shut it down until we get a cure, a vaccination. We don't have a flu vaccine. And we have a polio vaccine that will prevent you from getting polio, but we don't have a flu vaccine because you can get the flu vaccine and still get the flu. So what's to say that this vaccine that they're rushing to get is going to be the end-all, cure-all, or that might even exist? I'm over it.
Well, and I think as far as in Nick Saban had a very – and as it stands right now, the Big 12 – the SEC and the ACC play college football. Tulane's going to open up with hopefully an opponent. Southeastern had a back out without fans, but that's okay. And it's interesting if the SEC if they do play, these three conferences will have a competitive advantage over the Pac-10 and the Big Ten for the remainder of time. Because, it usually takes, some little competitive advantage that gets, the number one recruit from, Ohio State to LSU. And they will be able to utilize for the rest of time that, hey, our commitment to play football here is a lot greater than there is on the East Coast and the West Coast. And if you go to these schools and you have some type of disruption in society, you may lose your dream to play in the NFL because we're not going to play. And it's just an interesting, I think it's an opportunity for the SEC.
Selling
plus, plus, could you imagine Saturday afternoons with just SEC games on and nobody else, what the ratings would be? They would be,
right.
Through the roof because they'd be the only game in town. But, again, Nick Saban was criticized.
You're talking uh-huh. about football, but you can spread that across every industry in the country. Listen, we're going to keep working. We're not going to stay at home and shelter in place and do this. We're going to keep working. We're going to do this. And your business is going to have a competitive advantage over other businesses because whatever market or industry that you're in, because you're now taking advantage of this opportunity to go to work and do it safely, and wipe things down and socially distance and do what you can do to keep things, like we've done at our office. Our lawyers each have their own separate office. We have a large conference room. Our clients sit at one end with a mask. We sit at the other. So we do things to minimize the risk while at the same time going to work and getting our job done for our clients. And I think that's going to help us, in moving forward because, I'm thanking God we have that opportunity. We've been designated by the COVID gods as essential, just like Academy Sporting Goods was, or the plant store or these other places that it's, why is the plant store, essential? Why isn't, we can go on and on about it.
Yeah, one thing I did want to say, and I think Coach Saban was right, because Coach Saban, the good part about Coach Saban, he doesn't care whether he's liked or not, like most people who are in the public eye. They want to be liked before they say the truth.
Yeah.
And what he said is the way this is presented by maybe like ESPN and some of the other national outlets is, the only way you can get is that guys can't get a virus unless they play football. In reality, you can get it anywhere. Just even hanging out in your dormitory or with immediate family. And that's the reality of this.
Right.
And, you know, right. And to take, you know, the tradition, every fall in the South, Louisiana, high school football, college football is part of our culture. It is where we see friends and family that we don't only see once a year. It is, we celebrate who we are. At LSU, we celebrate our culture. We celebrate every aspect of Louisiana. And it's very interesting that you have people in leadership who are so reticent to take that away for whatever reason, fear, politics, or whatever. But you know, it's unbelievable. The way it is presented that if you go play football, you can get the virus. Where if you don't play football, it probably won't happen. In fact, all these, like at LSU, they're getting tested every day. It's probably safer for them to play football than do anything else in society right now because they're getting tested every day. Where else? When you go to Walmart and shopping, everyone's not getting tested. If you go to a protest, you're sure as heck not being tested. But for college football, the players and the coaches, the equipment managers, everyone is getting tested. So it's probably not a safer place to be. And I think Coach Saban spoke a lot of wisdom among a lot of criticism from one, King Hill, who was the president of LSU, who's now in Oregon on the left coast. Thank God, stay there on the left coast. I'm glad you're not at LSU, saying that he doesn't live in reality. But, you know, again, this is, you know, it's just I just wanted to present a ultimate viewpoint because it only seems like we only get one viewpoint. If you look at the empirical data, and what if I read from today, from the ages of 15 to 64, you have more to fear from pneumonia and the flu from a perspective of death than you
no
do
question.
COVID. So,
and you got to think about, we got 365 million people in this country. And we're talking, you know, in the it's just crazy.
Yeah,
the wise based upon this. Listen, it's horrible. It's real. You know, and I've talked to doctors, people in the medical field that they've witnessed those deaths. It's terrible. There's no question about it. But we know enough about the virus to know who the people are that we need to protect most. So let's spend our money, our efforts, our resources protecting those people. You know, let them stay at home and give them the unemployment issues, you know, because we know what their medical condition is. And so give them the unemployment and let everybody else go back to work.
It does look like we're going to have college football this year at LSU as it stands now. It looks like things are trending downward. And God bless the SEC for having guts to stand up to the rest of Stay tough. Stay tough, Stanky. Let's have football. Okay, let's go to a break. Doug Cinceri, Albert Nico, you Weekend Lawyers. We'll be right back after this brief timeout. Hey, we're back. Doug Cinceri, Albert Nico, you Weekend Lawyers. Let's go to phone lines. Let's go to Leon. Hey, Leon, you and all things legal. How can we help you?
All right. Well, good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning. And,
nice talking to y'all again. I have a tax problem. I went and did my taxes with H&R Block and got the protection plan and everything. And the COVID-19 set everything back. And then I think it was June or July 15th, they was going to start taking the money out the bank. And they didn't take a penny out my bank account. And then I get a letter yesterday saying that I owe them, you know, the $37.50, okay, which I told them to take, you know, my accountant, H&R Block, told them to take $500 a month out of my account, which they hadn't done. And then I get the letter, and then I'm getting penalized $1,000 because I ain't paid it. And now on September 7th, they want the whole nine yards.
All right, Let me do this. A couple things. One, I'd recommend you call the Bryson Law Firm, Bryson. They are advertiser on the WWL, and they do that, and they're local. Bryson, number one.
Yeah.
We don't do tax law, but I could tell you a couple of things you need to do. I know the IRS is not answering the phone right now. When you call over there, they're saying there's a recording, and that they're working remotely. What I have found was, and what I found that works with the IRS in this period, and it's not easy, but constantly sending them communications by certified mail for the response. And you make a paper trail as far as, hey, this, you know, sort of do a diary of each day. On this day, we agreed to this. On this day, you know, we agreed to this. On this day, the IRS indicated that they would be taking $500 out of my account on this day. And make a diary and continue to document what has occurred and what the IRS is not doing in response to their agreement. Because you're dealing with a bureaucratic morass. That's the only thing I'm saying. I can say, and I'm saying that. And please don't. If someone's from the IRS, please don't audit me. I'm just telling you the way it is. But it is very. They're not very responsive. Now, what does happen is if you do have everything documented, and you continue to send follow-up documentation explaining their inaction, eventually you will get someone who will read your file, and read what occurred, and would be more likely to make the proper adjustments. So in the interim period, you're going to have to document. Now, it takes a lot of work on your behalf. And, you know, you're going to have to be your own advocate. And, you know, and you can't, you know, you're going to have to cover yourself. But what I would do is keep a diary. And every time you write them, you relate to them when, what occurred, when it occurred, what agreements they made, and what agreements did they not make. Or follow through on. And continue to send follow-up letters once every week or two and saying, hey, you know, I've been assessed $1,000 and, you know, it's because you didn't do what you agreed to do in trying to resolve this tax debt. And then at some point you may get a supervisor who will read all your letters and read about the futility of the IRS in addressing your particular problem. And then at that point, they will make adjustments. And so I found that has worked. Eventually, you'll have someone there who does a good job, who understands that, you know, they have not followed up on their representations, and he makes it right for you. But you're going to have to do the work to put yourself in that position. All right, Leon?
Okay. One other question.
Yes.
Should I send them the $3,700, or should I send this these letters certified?
I send them certified. I send them certified, and I would pay what you originally agreed to pay under the agreement, or if they're taking the money out of the account, explain to them that was what they were supposed to do. Leon, also, I'd recommend you call Bryson Law Firm, B-R-Y-S-O-N Law Firm, if you had any other questions. They do a great job with that. Thanks for the call. Let's go to a break. Doug Cinceri, Albert Nico, your weekend lawyers, all things legal. We'll be right back after this brief time out. Hey, we're back. Doug Cinceri, Albert Nico, your weekend lawyers. Let's go to phone lines. Let's go to Larry. Hey, Larry, you on all things legal.
Hi, good morning, guys.
Are you Larry?
Larry's wife.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, but Paul's about me. Yeah.
Okay, it's not Larry identifying as his wife. It's his wife, right?
Larry's wife.
From Covington, from God's country. All right. Hey, Larry. Yeah. Okay, Mrs. Larry, what can I do for you?
Okay. So a few months ago, back in June, I took a job full-time. I originally applied for it PRN, and which means as needed. I work. I work in a hospital. So... my boss asked me, you know, would you consider going full time? I was skeptical, but I did. When I did, they offered me a $5,000 incentive, and I took it, and I just put it in the bank. Mm-hmm. Since then, I changed back. I flipped my status, PRN, for personal reasons, and I worked hospitals. So that was my decision. And so we did that. And then I called the hospital and said, hey, I want to pay back this incentive. Mm-hmm. So human resources said it took about 2 days for him to call me back. And they said, I said, look, I'm going to come pay back the $3,000. How do you want me to pay it, over the phone, in person? They said, oh, no, you've got to pay back the entire $5,000. And I said, well, I already paid $2,000 over to you guys for the IRS. which was my taxes, and then I received three. So if I pay you back five, then that means I've already paid out $2,000 to the IRS, and then I'm giving you five. So then I'm out seven.
Right.
So
that's a very interesting question. And I think it's was there any type of documentation or agreements in connection issued with the $5,000 incentive? In other words, any stipulations as to what would occur if you switch back to PRN?
No, not for that particular scenario, no.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't seem like I spoke to the vice president in finance, payroll. I called them a week ago, and they're still looking into it because it doesn't seem that anyone – my CPA said – my personal CPA wrote a letter for me to the hospital, and he said, listen, this is not – the employee does not give you $5,000
back. Right. You know,
this $2,000 was withheld for the IRS out of her check just a few weeks ago. That should be canceled. You get your $2,000 back as a corporation, and the employee gives you the $3,000 back, and there's your $5,000.
Let me ask you this. How long did you work full-time?
There for a very short time.
Like how many weeks?
Because I got sick.
How long?
So.
How long?
Since June.
Okay, so you worked about 3 months, and did you?
Yeah.
You got sick. Was it a work related sickness?
Yes.
It was.
Corona. It was COVID.
COVID. Okay, well then, you know what? You may have an argument not to have to pay it back. I mean, I would say, you know, you'd have to advocate yourself, and it's not defined as to what would occur as far as that incentive if you contracted Corona on the job. So
yeah.
What I would do,
and I want to give them the $3,000 back because I don't want to do anything.
Well,
maybe
you have to take a different position so that you go in a negotiation position so they'll agree to only take $3,000 because you could say this from an advocacy point of view is I was given a $5,000 incentive. However, you did not define when I received this $5,000 incentive what would occur if I contracted Corona in the course and scope of my employment. So I think there's a question as to whether I'll pay it back. And if you push me,
okay.
I won't. And I have a legal argument not to. But in an effort to compromise this particular situation, I'm willing to give back X. Okay? It's always good to start at a negotiation position, especially when you're dealing with a hospital, which is a bureaucracy, and say, hey, I don't think I owe anything. Okay? Because I contracted Corona, and therefore I'm going to go back to working PRN.
And I am, if I may, I don't want to get into a whole nother scenario, but just for a second, just one statement. I am advocating for myself since the illness because, you know, I was out of work for a month, and I work at another hospital as well, and no pay, nothing while I was out.
Well, I would say this. I would play the card saying I don't owe anything, but I'm willing to do this. And if you don't want to, I'm not paying it back. And let them put the ball in their court. It's just negotiation.
Yeah.
Give us a call at 504-837-1304 if you want to talk about it a little bit more. We can, maybe help give you some benchmarks or positions to take. All right. Thanks for the call. Let's go to break. Doug Cinceri, Albert Nico, your weekend lawyers, all things legal. We'll be right back after this brief time out. Hey, we're back. Doug Cinceri, Albert Nico, weekend lawyers, all things legal. Let's go to phone lines. Let's go to Albert's got a question. Hey, Albert, what you got for us, brother?
Hey, guys. Happy Sunday. Question. Do you know if the universities that intend to play football this fall are going to require the football players to sign a waiver of liability related to the COVID virus? And if so, would those waivers hold up if a court challenge?
That's a good question. I would suspect they may.
Louisiana, I think it's going to vary state by state. Louisiana Civil Code Article 2004 is specifically on point when it comes to limiting your liability for personal injuries, which this could be considered a personal injury or an event of sickness, whatever. It's kind of like saying, look, come work for me in an asbestos plant, but you're going to sign this waiver of liability if you get sick and contract, you know, mesothelioma. You can't contract away your rights for personal injury. So when you're playing in a basketball league and they say, here, sign this personal injury waiver, in Louisiana, it's not worth the paper it's written on. So, you know, I'm sure that varies state to state. This is a, you know, again, a civil code article from the, you know, Napoleonic code. So I'm guessing that other states.
Here's the other problem with COVID. How do you determine causation? I mean, how can you determine that you caught COVID on a football game as opposed to when you went to Walmart or you went, you know, to somewhere else or you went to, you know.
Along with that, say you have a lineman, and the linemen are already complaining about those face guards affecting their breathing. So you suppose you have a lineman who's encouraged by somebody who doesn't want them to be playing football, but a lineman comes along and says, my breathing was affected by having to wear this, whatever it was, that face guard. So I have a respiratory problem now.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, first of all, if they do play college football, all the players are going to be tested before they get on the field. So the fact that they have been tested and they're all negative is probably your best defense to contracting COVID, because they're saying, well, you know, where else? Like I said, when you went to Walmart 2 days ago, was everybody in Walmart tested? No. Was everybody on the football field tested? So, yes.
All right.
So from a pragmatic
– this could be an injury related to COVID but not COVID. Like if a lineman's going to claim – his breathing system was affected because of having to wear that protective shield.
Well, they'd have to have the science behind it if they did. That's all I'd have to say. They'd have to have the science to prove that, which would sound like that would be quite a leap from a medical causation perspective. But
okay, guys.
All right, my man. Thanks for call. Well, you know, I think we got about a minute and a half, Albert. But you know. As I guess we'll talk about it the next hour. We spent a little time on talking about this in the beginning because all of these restrictions, all these lockdowns, all these restrictions put in by government have a profound, you know, effect on, you know, clients who are businessmen, employers, on how they do business. You know, when they enter into contracts, it has a very profound effect because they're inhibited from performing their services for things that are totally out of their control. And often when that occurs, that, you know, leads itself to legal issues. So we'll talk a little bit about it in the second hour. So we're going to go to a news break. We're going to go to national news, we're going to local news. And we'll be back for hour number two on all things legal in about 10 minutes. So stay tuned. Look forward to seeing you back. Hey, we're back. Doug Sincera, Albert Nico. Your weekend lawyers, hour number two. You can also call us at a law firm at 504-837-1304, 504-837-1304, or North Shore at 985-624-9697. And Albert, the Pelicans have fired Alvin Gentry, which when that happened, you were the first person that came to mind when that occurred.
Yep. You know, He's not had a winning record in the five head coaching jobs that he's had over the course of his time at those different places. So why do you give him another contract? Last year you cleaned house. You got rid of, you know, Anthony Davis. You got a new front office man. You did everything. And then you keep Alvin Gentry, who, I mean, you know, just a novice like me can see mistake after mistake after mistake that he makes. And, you know, it just from clock management to player time and
rotations,
flow of the game, it's frustrating to watch. You know, my wife would say, why do you watch? She said, it just frustrates you over and over again. I said, I know. I said, I'm a sucker for it. But
well, I think they probably need to get someone in who's very, very hands-on, very more of a disciplinarian, to sort of mold a bunch of young. They're very young. And, you know, one of the things we don't realize, Zion Williamson's 20. Lonzo Ball is 22. I mean, you know, Jackson Hayes is 19 or 20. I mean, they're kids. I mean, they are literally kids. And a lot of times their greatest development doesn't occur until they're 24, 25, 26, just based on maturity. And a lot of this, you know, you can't – and I think Alvin Gentry's philosophy was – treat them like pros. You know, they're professionals. But and that works for some players who've been in the league 10, 12 years, maybe Derek Favors, who's, you know, been in the league 10, 12 years or what have you. But it doesn't work for 19-year-old kids. I mean, you need to be on them, and you need a different style of coaching that probably Coach Gentry had for such a young team. If you had a veteran team, maybe it's a little different. But, you know, so that's you know, so we'll see. We'll see. I think Jason Kidd probably has a very good chance. Or Tyrone Lue seems to be the front runners, unless they get a assistant coach out there who's rising. But, you know, Wally Williams isn't looking so bad these days. And also the Saints announced that they're not going to play in front of fans for the opening game, but they are playing, which is something. So, preseason camp is marching ahead, and we saw it in the dark as to, you know, what's happening there. But I guess we'll see. It'll bring a new dimension if not having any preseason and just starting the season. So, we will see. Do you know now? One interesting thing that happened. And this is history. On August 18th, 1962, AFL had an exhibition game involving the Houston Oilers and the Boston Patriots. And they had 31,000 people show up at City Park Stadium, and they had to turn away 7,000 people. And the game involved Billy Cannon, who was playing for the Houston Oilers, and two other Louisiana players, Charlie Toler and Charles Hennington, who are from Northwestern. And I think you go back to 1962 and you think, you know, what was probably one of the catalysts for the Saints getting a professional football team? Well, when you have a preseason game at City Park Stadium and you had a turn, you know, had 31,000 people when it could hold 26,000, and then you had to turn 7,000 away, that was a pretty good indication that New Orleans would be a great football town. So that's just, you know.
They're test supporters, you know.
Yes, yeah. So we're all looking forward to it, even though we can't see them in the stands. At least they'll be playing. And we will see. You know, we were talking a little bit about, you know, obviously if you listen to us, you know, we have very strong feelings as to, you know, how certain things are being handled as far as, you know, law, government, as far as, you know, the pandemic's concerned. But, you know, they have real consequences of how does it shape the legal, I guess, the legal environment in connection with COVID. And I have a question for you, Albert. And if you're sending your child, okay, to a school maybe on the East Coast where they're going to maybe brainwash your kid for 4 years before they come back, but like an East Coast college, you know, in the Northeast, and you're paying $70,000 to pay tuition, and then you send them up to Pennsylvania or New York or Massachusetts to go to one of these schools, and they rent an apartment or rent a dormitory for maybe, you know, $3,000 or $4,000 a semester, have all these other expenses, and then they tell you you have to go to class online. Do you think those students have a legitimate claim to get a rebate on their tuition?
I mean, I don't see why not. You know, why are you going to make it to where the students have to suffer, right? I mean, I guess you need to find out what the contract says, and you can bet that the contract for the fall semester is completely differently written than the contract for the spring semester this year. Because the spring semester, nobody knew about COVID in the beginning of the spring semester, and now everybody does. And so people's contracts for this coming year, different schools, even local schools, the Catholic schools, private schools, wherever, you know, they've revised their contracts to basically say, look, you understand that this is how it's going to be, and we may have to make decisions on the fly, and you agree to them, and we're going to hold you to the contract, and
understand that this is a pandemic and we're going to do what we have to do and make decisions, and you're going to have to agree with them. So with that said, it's a little harder this semester, I think, to make a claim that, you know, you are all of a sudden unaware that now you might have to go to online classes and still pay the same amount. I can tell you, there were some students, and I don't know the difference, but I think it's pretty close to the same, that went to summer school at UNO to catch up on a class or two, which, of course, is not covered by TOPS. And even at UNO, a three-hour class online was like $1,700, mm-hmm. which is probably in line with the normal tuition. So there was no real break that was given to the, you know, to the student, because they, you know, they had an online class. They're getting a three hours worth of credit from that university. So, you know, in their mind, I guess the university's mind, you know, you're getting credit, you're getting taught. And, you know, I think it's going to be a hard sell to try to say, hey, look, we want our money back now, or we didn't know we were getting, you know, having to do online training or whatever else.
I know a lot, some of the Ivy League schools are having all their classes online. I think Harvard Law School may be having that. And, mm-hmm. you know, you pay an obscene amount of money to go to Harvard Law School. And, you know, theoretically, yep. you could go to Harvard Law School and live in Louisiana under online, you know, school and not miss a beat. I mean, it would be the same if you're sitting in some, you know, some dorm room in, or apartment in Boston or wherever. And as far as going to school. So it's an interesting question when it comes to legal question of COVID is, what are you contract for? What are you getting? And, you know, what is the difference between experiencing college online versus experiencing the college as far as just college life, you know, dormitory life, you know, campus life, extracurriculars life, belonging to, you know, and paying the same tuition. And it's just an interesting question to see if they'll continue to have. And there is a bunch of litigation and class action suits on that particular issue. But, those are one of the questions, legal questions, on how things are very, you know, the legal implications of how do you deal with certain contractual agreements and contractual, a contract for education in the midst of COVID. Mm-hmm.
Well, and again, I think, like I said, I think that this year now, this fall, mm-hmm. you know, you start off with that preposition. I mean, that proposition that a contract, unless it is against public policy, is the law between the parties. You know, we have disappointed clients come to the office all the time and say, yeah, well, you know, I didn't know what that meant when I signed it, or I didn't read that, or I didn't read the contract, and now I'm stuck in this bad deal. Well, there's case law everywhere that says it's not the function of the court to get you out of a bad deal that you made. You agreed to it. You're presumed to have read it. You signed it. You're presumed to know what it meant. And so, you know, the people that just blindly click I agree on all of these software programs, or Google and Microsoft, and I set up a new phone yesterday, same thing. You agree to those terms and conditions. So unless it's somehow against public policy that the company is really just taking advantage of the consumer, you're going to have a hard time doing something or having a court change that contract in your favor.
Right, right. And now there are some laws, like in Louisiana, it's called the Louisiana Unfair Trade Practices Act, which provides a remedy for consumers or for people in business for any type of deceptive or unscrupulous type of business practices. And in under certain circumstances, if you do agree to a contract, but it turns out to be it was unscrupulous or deceptive, there could be some type of liability under that particular statute. But for the most part, Albert's right. is that, I mean, correct in saying, hey, if you sign a contract, you probably have to live with it. Let's go to a break. Doug Sinceri, Albert Nicoya, Weekend Lawyers, All Things Legal. We'll be right back after this brief timeout. Hey, we're back. Doug Sinceri, Albert Nicoya, Weekend Lawyers, All Things Legal. I guess we're sort of talking about how maybe sometimes COVID and the pandemic and all the remedial action that's being taken is affecting, you know, I guess legal relationships. And Albert, also, if, you know, if you're in the service industry and or you provide supplies or you're a vendor for companies, it might be a good time to start rewriting your contracts because, you know, a lot of contracts, when you provide a service now, does not provide a contingency as to if you have a shutdown like we've had for the last 5 months and how to deal with that.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you are contracting for a service, I mean, many people, you know, just show up at your restaurant, they show up at your retail establishment. There's no real written contract as to, you know, what you're going to provide. Even from an employment standpoint, very few people have employment contracts. And those, again, are going to be, you know, going to be changed as we move forward as well. But and we talked about this a few shows ago. You know, if you're a venue provider, you know, if you're the chicory or the cannery or one of these places that has weddings and other events at their venue, there needs to be some documentation and some changes to your contract because you're now, you know, what if all of a sudden you have to start taking the temperature of everyone that walks in? Okay, so let's put that in the contract that, listen, there may be an upcharge related to any pandemic or virus or government mandates that we're required to engage in order to put on this event. So if we now have to put hand sanitizer stations everywhere, or if we have to have, like I said, someone taking temperatures, or two or three people, because everybody arrives at the same time usually, out there taking temperatures, or we've got to now put up, you know, certain spit screens and things of those nature to protect the public, that cost is going to have to be passed along to the consumer, and, you know, they need to be aware of that. It should be in your contract. And just even, you know, just from an added expense provision, but then also a provision where we may have to cancel your event. And if we do, here's how it's going to work as to your reimbursement. You know, we have some hard costs that we've incurred. And even if it's a month out, you know, we booked it, we planned it, we had a salesperson that, you know, sat with you and planned your menu. So there's a non-refundable cost that should be put into the contract that said, hey, look, we tried to book it and we will do our best to reschedule you. And that, you know, and then you won't have to incur that fee. But if you decide, hey, look, I'm just going to go get, you know, married at the courthouse and we'll plan a wedding later or do something later, then that fee should be earned. And it should be part of the contract as well.
Yeah, and I mean, and you know, as far as the business is concerned, I'll sort of draw a parallel. We were talking about earlier about college football. Now you have like the SEC teams and the Big Ten and the ACC looks like they're going to play. They have the resources necessary to pay for all the COVID-related expenses to assure compliance and safety. Now I think a lot of these small colleges wanted to play football, but they can't, because their athletic budget doesn't allow for all the, I guess, remediation that's necessary for, you know, maybe for playing because it's too expensive. And, you know, I'll draw that parallel with other service, you know, businesses or other situations where if you do provide a service and that in your contract you don't have some type of provision saying, hey, if the government requires additional, or, you know, the government or some municipality requires additional remediation before you can conduct your business, that we can charge for that expense in for that compliance. You may not be able to charge for it. In other words, you know, so it's sort of a new world, and all these type of one of the things that occurs in all type of, I guess, when you make laws, when you make edicts, when you make fiats that may not be constitutional, but you do it anyway, that require compliance, it always has unintended consequences. And a lot of times these unintended consequences have unintended, I guess, legal implications and expenses. And I think, you know, as we're 5 months into this, we're sort of seeing a lot of these, expenses and unintended consequences and these legal implications of what's been occurring and how that affects businesses one way or the other. I think, Albert, you do a lot of construction contracts, and you've gone through this before. If you build
that's one
a
thing
house
I'm dealing with right now. I'm representing a client across the lake. They started building a house in 2017. And all of a sudden, in August, you know, their contractor was from Baton Rouge. All of a sudden, the Denham Springs and that whole area floods, and the cost of materials spikes. And so now that contractor's under this deadline to finish his work, and he can't get the materials for the price that he quoted, and so he kept pushing the job off. Well, of course, there was nothing in his contract regarding that contingency, and that was something that contractor should have learned, and a lot of us learned in Katrina. You know, we're building a house, all of a sudden I want to build it for this price. Well, now I have no laborers because they're everywhere. They're working, you know, a lot of them went out on their own, went into business for themselves, you know, gutting houses and putting things back. And of course, we get a lot of litigation where that's concerned, in the poor workmanship. But a lot, you know, so they couldn't find their subs anymore, and there were conditions and circumstances beyond the contractor's control that needed to be addressed in their contract and say, hey, look, we thought about this, and this was, you know, this was anticipated by the parties. And so there was a meeting of the minds between the parties with respect to what happens in the event of XYZ. And so if you know, now all of a sudden this contractor's kind of stuck because he agreed to a price and he couldn't come in, and so they had to terminate him. You know, he should have been finished the job, and he didn't even finish the framing. And so they had to terminate him, and now he wants additional monies, you know, but my client said, wait a minute, I had to spend all this additional money to finish the job that went over the contract price, and also to correct a lot of your work. So, you know, that's kind of the battle that we're having right now, and we see it over and over again. That's just one example of it.
It's always the what-if questions before you get started. So if the what-if happens, you know how to deal with it. All right, let's go to a break. Let's go to break. Doug Cinceri, Albert Nico, your Weekend Lawyers. We'll be right back after this brief timeout. Hey, we're back. Doug Cinceri, Albert Nico, your Weekend Lawyers. All things legal. You can call us at our law firm also at 504-837-1304 in Metairie, 504-837-1304, or in Mandeville in God's Country, 985-624-9697. Albert, I was driving around running errands yesterday in God's Country in the North Shore. And I was riding up and down Highway 59. I was up Highway 22, 21, by the Target. I was astounded to see all the vacancies in retail space. A lot of places that had, just mom-and-pop stores that are now vacant and for rent. And, I was really taken by it, and I started thinking about, you know, the landlords and the tenants who are in these, obviously, either walked on these leases. And I wanted you to get to explain, if you sign a lease and you're a commercial tenant or a commercial landlord, if you sign a lease and you own an LLC, but you sign it as a personal guarantee. What is the implications of that?
Well, again, of course, it's going to say what the lease has to say about it. You know, and very few leases, you know, are anticipating any of this. You know, it there is an act of God provision. It's a force majeure provision in the civil code that also talks about tries to anticipate a situation where the parties really didn't figure that something was going to happen one way or the other. But if you can perform, but it just makes the performance more difficult, then you're bound by the contract. And so if there's something that makes the contract impossible to perform, for instance, you know, you had a wedding planned in October in a reception hall in Mid-City in October of 2005. Well, all of a sudden Katrina hits. Well, of course the it's flooded. It got 6-8 feet of water in it. It was something that was impossible to perform. And so the law would allow the reception hall, the venue to skate on that, or basically not have any liability because, you know, it was impossible to perform. But the fact is, if you can be open, but even though you're open, you know, with, you know, two hairstylists instead of five, and you're having trouble making ends meet, by law, you still have the obligation to pay that rent. And even though you're now from a practical, like we always like to do, what's practical, right? From a practical landlord perspective, that landlord needs to work with that tenant because it would be very unlikely that someone else is going to come along and want to offer them full rent for that space during this period of time. And so what a lot of folks are doing is saying, listen, you know, we're going to give you, if they can, right? Because they've got their own mortgages to pay.
Right, that's right.
But
which people often forget.
Yeah, of course. Oh, yeah. And so they're saying, listen, we're going to give you some time, or we're going to let you go in at, you know, if we're at 50%, we'll let you go in at 50% rent. But we're going to add these months to the end of your lease and the end of your obligation, and you're going to pay us that difference, you know, spread out over the course of the term. So when you go back to full blast, you know, retail business, we're going to start that period, and then at that point, we're going to take the amount that you haven't paid and spread it over the course of the remainder of the lease and not count these months where we gave you a break. And so we're going to push everything. Let's say it's 6 months. We're going to push everything back 6 months, and we're going to take whatever rent you didn't pay in that 6 months and spread it across the remaining term. And that way, you know, you're doing what you can to help work with the person. Like you said, Doug, a lot of folks, I had a client, good client of mine. She's got a business, and she signed personally on the lease, and the landlord is being, you know, and she can open, and, you know, but she's, it's a very limited ability to open because, you know, the mayor that's never run a business in her life, and is still being paid said that she can't open full speed.
I like that.
As a result, this person is now going to perhaps have to file personal bankruptcy as well because the landlord is holding fast to the terms of the lease. I think kind of stupidly because, you know, I guess the landlord figures that, you know, she maybe has the money, so we'll get it from her until, you know, till things calm down, and then we'll go back and release that space because it's a pretty hot location. So, but again, it's just it. For every case, there's a different answer.
Now, also too, and I mean, here's some suggestions because a lot of times, if you're doing your first business, if you're like opening up your first business, you're opening your first Subway, or you're opening some type of retail business, and you sign a lease or even a service agreement business, that you know, that you'll have your LLC as the lessor, but you sign as a personal guarantee. And a lot of times when these leases come back, because we see them when there's a dispute. It's not, you know, they're not an issue unless they become an issue. they're surprised to know I signed as a personal guarantor. And they were saying, well, I really didn't understand what I was doing when I did that, or I didn't understand I would be personally liable. But, right. You know, that I mean, basically it says if you're a landlord, if you have an L, you don't, you know, so you want more protection than an LLC that could have, that become, could become insolvent, and you wouldn't be able to get any, have, be able to have the ability to collect outside the LLC. But there may be certain things, if they, if there is a personal guarantee, maybe there are certain things you could do to limit the liability if they make you pay that. Maybe you could have a cap on how much you would pay as a personal guarantor, or you could maybe right. have more restrictive circumstances as to the liability of a personal guarantor, so that, you know, if something went south, you wouldn't be, you know, totally devastated financially, or it would mitigate the damages to do that. But a lot of times,
from a landlord's perspective, if someone doesn't want to sign a personal guarantee, then the answer is, well, so you're saying that you won't back personally your LLC or your corporation. Uh-huh. Want me to? Is that what you're saying? You want me to bear that risk of your company failing when you're in charge of that company and you're the one that has, you know, the day to, in charge of the day-to-day operations of that company, and all of a sudden now you want me to assume that risk by you being able to say, look, sorry, landlord, I didn't make it, and I can't pay the rest of my rent. See you later. I don't have any assets, and you can't come after me personally.
Now,
so I think there's a pretty good argument that, hey, look, you know, if you're going to make me step up, I'm going to make you step up and guarantee that rent.
And let me ask you this: if you're a new tenant and you open a business, what provision would you want to have, or how would you define a provision as far as protecting you if you are only able to operate under impaired circumstances, that you can operate but can't fully operate due to some type of governmental restriction? What would you recommend the tenant? What kind of language you would want the tenant to have in there?
Well, ideally you want, I mean, if you know, your starting point is some government provision or mandate that prevents me from working at full capacity for whatever reason, whether there's, you know, a power outage to the location, or a road, that the road in front of my building being, you know, worked on for a year and a half, you know, because that's how the city does it. Then you get some sort of abatement, some sort of relief, or look, we don't have to pay rent, and or we'll pay. You know, look, let's work out a gross revenue provision on the rent. So let's go back a year while I was doing good, and figure out what percentage of the gross revenues that my rent turned out to be, and then let's give you that number, and that way, look, you're still making some money, you're still moving forward, and not, you know,
So
not coming up with zero, and I'm still have the opportunity to keep my business open.
You know, it just goes to show you, everything's negotiable. Okay, let's go to a break. Doug Cinceri, Albert Nico, your Weekend Lawyers. We'll be right back after this brief timeout. Hey, we're back. Doug Cinceri, Albert Nico, your Weekend Lawyers, all things legal. Let's go to phone lines. Eddie's got a question regarding a short sale. Hey, Eddie.
How you doing?
Good. What you have? What's going on, man?
Okay. I owned a house for 18 years. There's still a first and a second mortgage. Because of financial situations, we're forced to sell, and we're doing a short sale because we were told that the Internal Revenue would not look for any money because of the short sale.
Okay.
Correct,
Albert. you're saying that because the IRAs, I mean, because you were loaned a certain amount of money and you're giving it back.
If the mortgage company reports to the Internal Revenue that they didn't get all their money, or we have to claim that as income, and I was told no because it's a primary residence for over 5 years.
That's a CPA question. I think you might be better off asking a CPA their interpretation.
Wonderful. So we're going to do what Julian Fagan used to do with the New Orleans Saints. We're going to punt. All right, 1968.
Yeah.
All right.
All right.
So do you remember? So if you remember Julian Fagan, you are a very astute Saints fan. So we're going to punt on that one. So or more appropriately, we're going to do what Russell Erksleben attempted to do was punt. So there you go. But thanks for the call, Shorts. And, you know, basically, we can tell you short sale. Albert, you could explain real quick what a short sale is.
Don't know.
Well, I think what it's doing is basically selling back the mortgage to a third party and getting out from under the mortgage because unable to pay his notes. So it's basically selling your property before foreclosure so that you don't have to. So that you don't undergo into foreclosure, and also too, you won't have a deficiency if you do go to foreclosure and the sheriff's sale is less than or the net proceeds is less than the amount that's owed. So there you go. But that might be a Saturday morning question on the money show or something else like that. But we got about 2 or 3 minutes, Albert, and I think we're. Let's see, we're about 3 or 4 weeks away from Saints opening day. And
Today we should be about the Saints' first preseason game.
Yes, we should.
It would have happened, right?
Yes, it would have happened. You know, I would like to have 2 preseason games. I think 4 is much. Do you remember in the old days when they had 6 preseason games?
Yeah.
I mean, that was too much. You'd have, in fact, the first Saints preseason, they lost the first one, won the next 5. In 1967, and they were thinking, "Hey, you know, we're going to be the greatest expansion team ever." And but I think 2 would do it. But 0 preseason gives
the players
very difficult
for that.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the stars don't play, but a lot of the grunt players play those games because they just don't have enough positions to fill. And it's something I think that the Players Association has been asking for a while.
Yeah, so I wonder, I mean, the only problem is these undrafted free agent rookies won't get it, you know, probably won't get the chance they would if they had 4 preseason games, but hopefully maybe in practice they'll show it. But anyway, so we're getting close. It looks like there's going to be football in the South, as it should be, because the South's about food, family, and football, as well as God and hard work. So we need football in the South, and I think it looks like we're going to get it while the other people in the East Coast and West Coast can twiddle their thumbs on Saturday afternoons and watch, I don't know, the cooking show or something. So we'll see you next.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of 4 amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get 4 iPhone 15s on us and 4 lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.